When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis, and today I'm with Dr. Van Wyk, and we're going to go over an update for traumatic brain injury. It's been 2017, I believe, since the CPG came out. So I think it's time to get what the latest information is on it. Dr. Van Wyk, if you would, for those who haven't listened or haven't heard you speak, would you mind giving a quick introduction?
Sure, absolutely. And let me thank you for having me on, Dennis, and say that it's a pleasure to be here and to talk to your audience about this topic that I'm pretty passionate about. So I am I'm a neurologist by training. I did my neurology residency at Madigan Army Medical Center out in Tacoma. And after I got done there, I went out and was a general neurologist in the Army. I got deployed to Afghanistan for about a year, came back and got the opportunity to do a neurocritical care fellowship at Duke University Hospital. So I was there for 2 years, came back out, and I was with the hospital for about a year, and then had the opportunity to go over to 3rd Special Forces Group. So I'm a battalion surgeon over there right now. And in doing all of this, I had the opportunity to do some of the prolonged field care training, meet the folks involved in the prolonged field care working group. I was invited to help author the traumatic brain injury management in prolonged field care CPG a couple years ago in 2017. And I'm happy to be back and to talk a little bit about some of the updates in TBI management, particularly in that setting, and some of the changes that might be up and coming in the updated versions of these CPGs.
Well, I think the first thing I'd like to talk about is in October 2019, the CRASH III trial came out. Is there any takeaways from that we need to be looking for?
Yeah, CRASH III is one of the trials that I've been asked about most frequently by colleagues, not just in the operational medicine setting, but the academic setting. We've talked about that. And I think that it's worth kind of going back and just mentioning CRASH II briefly, because that's where CRASH III came from. And in CRASH II, obviously, which was looking at the effects on hemorrhage and the transfusion rates, with the use of that medication and trauma, subgroup analysis for CRASH II had suggested that outcomes may have been better in TBI patients who had received that medication. So it was decided to take a look at it more in depth in TBI in particular. And I think that there's a couple of takeaways and a couple of caveats associated with the CRASH III results. The authors had basically concluded that it was safe and it reduced head injury related death. And again, I would caveat that to a certain degree. One of the things I think that was shown across the board in this study was that it did seem to reduce overall mortality, at least in the first 24-hour period, for all the different categories of TBI. Now, that is probably related to the fact that it is an antifibrinolytic, so it limits the expansion of hematomas, of bleeding. And I think that we know from prior studies, we know from some prior literature on TXA, that it does do that effectively. That doesn't always translate into a good clinical outcome, but it does tend to save lives, or at least prolong life. So it's not a big surprise to see that. Another positive from this study is that, in contrast to some of the other TXA studies, like MATTERS, for example, that did show some higher rates of stroke, thromboembolism, seizure, I believe, as well, in the treatment groups, CRASH III really demonstrated in a rather large patient population, I might add, that administration of that of that treatment seems to be associated with very low complication risk. So it's generally safe to administer this this therapy to folks who need it and in the field. The question is who benefits from it, and I think that that's where it gets a little bit trickier to interpret. Overall, they didn't really meet their endpoints in showing that it was effective in TBI. But there's a couple of caveats to that. And in if you look at some of the subgroups, and the subgroups in this trial are huge, and they're actually working on a subgroup analysis to try to tease out some of the finer details in these different degrees of TBI that were included in the study. But if you look at the numbers, patients with a GCS of greater than 8, so your moderates and your milds, seem to do better in terms of outcome, higher survivability, better outcomes than the severe patients. That was a difference compared to CRASH 2, because there were a lot sicker patients involved in CRASH 3 overall. So I think that some of the reason that they might not have seen as much of a benefit and met their primary endpoints is because it was diluted by the more moribund patients that were included in this patient population than what we had seen in CRASH 2. So it looks like there may be a benefit to the moderates and then to certain mild TBI patients who get TXA, both in terms of clot expansion and then the proposed anti-inflammatory effect that might have as well. It just doesn't seem to be as effective in the severe patients, unfortunately. So, that I think those are kind of the take-home messages. And you know, people ask me would I give it to a TBI patient in the field. In one sense, it's a bit of a moot point because I think that most of our patients that have TBI are going to be polytraumas and have other indications to get TXA. So the vast majority of them, I think, are going to get TXA anyway. But if you had a moderate TBI and then certain mild TBIs, I think it's safe to give. And it's just going to be a matter of time before we can really determine either through subgroup analysis of this trial or additional trials as to how helpful it is in improving outcomes in TBI.
Okay. Now, CRASH 3, just like CRASH 1 and 2 and the MATTER study, they use conventional administration as far as giving 1 gram over 10 minutes and then infusing another gram over 8 hours. Lately, I've definitely been seeing a lot more guys just pushing 2 grams up front. Is there any evidence that this is any better than conventional dosing, or do you think it's more of a logistical issue?
Yeah, I've heard that, and I've talked to a couple of colleagues about that as well. And it's certainly been a question that has come up with the medics in our unit. And my answer is this: with TBI, and actually across the board, it's not necessarily a new dose because 2 grams has been given in a couple trials going back several years. With TBI, there was a paper 2012, 2013, 200 or so patients where they wanted to see if administering 2 grams of TXA up front limited hematoma expansion or progression in TBI patients who had been identified as having blood product on CT scans. And as I recall, that was a negative study. There wasn't much of a difference between the treatment group or the control group. I'm aware of a couple of studies in the ortho literature that have done 2 grams as well. But I think that this right now is more of a change that is resulting from the logistical challenges of using 1 gram up front and then another gram over 8 hours. Certainly, it'd be a lot more convenient for a medic to be able to push 2 grams up front and then move on to something else rather than have to frequently come back to a line that they have to manage over an 8 hour period. But I don't know of any hard data that says that the 2 grams is as effective or more effective than the traditional protocol that we derive from CRASH 2, which is the 1 gram up front and then the subsequent gram over 8 hours. So right now, it's something that is being discussed amongst the various committees, amongst the JTS and the professionals there, but they have not changed the recommendation to reflect that yet, and it remains the 1 gram up front followed by the 1 gram over 8 hours.
Okay. Now, there may not be any extra harm, and there may not be any extra benefit either, other than logistically. But since this is prolonged field care, I can see a lot of the units that have very rapid exfiltration, rapid medevac, where it wouldn't really be an issue because they're going to be on a surgeon's table here very shortly. But since this is prolonged field care and we have to stay outside for a lot longer, is there any downside? Because this drug has a half-life, and usually in prolonged field care, you go outside of that half-life of TXA, I believe, for 1 gram is roughly 2 hours. So hypothetically, 2 grams are roughly 4 hours-ish, maybe less. Is there any negative effects of going outside of that therapeutic effect? Because they're giving a loading dose and a follow-on infusion in the conventional dosing, I imagine, for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that we have a good answer for that, to be honest with you. I mean, certainly if you could look at some of the prior trials, like the one that I just mentioned, and ask yourself, especially since we have some newer data that has shown that TXA limits hematoma expansion in TBIs. You can go back to this earlier one that used 2 grams and ask yourself the question that you're asking right now. Does giving the medication all up front affect its efficacy down the road? And is that one of the reasons that that trial may have been a negative trial? And I think that that's something that's worth considering and looking at in the future, and bringing in some of the pharmacists and such that deal with some of those pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic issues. And frankly, that's one of the things that I think you want to answer before you start recommending a significant change in practice using a medication or an intervention like that. So it's worthwhile knowing that it works. And I don't know that it makes sense on one level to say, let's give it all up front. But I think it would be worthwhile knowing that it is just as effective as the traditional method, because we do know, after having done several trials with TXA, that traditional approach does seem to have the effect that we're looking for. Whereas the 2 grams, not necessarily, at least not yet.
Right. Moving off of TXA, since we've been talking about it for a while, hypertonic saline. So currently in the CPG, we recommend giving a 250 ml bolus of 3%. Is there any benefit to using a higher concentration?
Yeah, so when we originally did the CPG a couple years ago, this had actually come up, and the consensus amongst the group was that we wanted to go with a lower concentration, largely out of fear that a higher concentration might cause some problems, particularly because we would be running them through peripheral lines, so IVs and IOs. And there's always been a concern that it can cause some local tissue necrosis, for example, and thrombophlebitis. So the concern was, why don't we just stick with a lower concentration instead of trying to use a 23.4% or a higher concentration? Now, the downside to that, of course, is that if we're going to use 3%, that's going to require higher volumes to be administered to get the same effect. So that's more weight, more space being taken up in a medic's bag. So that has downsides to it as well. Further, you can only, if you are limited in your space, the amount that you can carry, that might be fewer doses that you can administer in a patient that you're not sure how long you're going to be stuck with. So that was the major limiting factor in considering that in the CPG a couple of years ago. Since then, there's been a couple of trials that have come out, both in animals and in humans, that have suggested that it is safe to administer 23.4% even through peripheral access. Even before we wrote the CPG, there was some data in pigs where they had looked at 3% and 7.5% going through an IO. Those pigs monitored over, I believe, a 5-day period it was, did not show significant changes in tissue morphology with the IO administration of hypertonic saline, nor did they have any changes in gait. They were looking at gait analysis as well. You could say, well, that was a lower concentration, so that doesn't necessarily reflect the question about 23.4%, and you'd be right. But there was a paper published in Neurocritical Care by a guy named Wang and his group back in 2017, I believe, where they had given IO 23.4% to traumatic brain injury patients with acute elevations in ICP. And not only was it shown to be effective and to not have any significant side effects being administered through that route, but not surprisingly, it was faster to give than trying to put in a central line, which is the traditional method or the traditional route that we administer 23.4% by. So I think that the typical dosing, which is 15 to 30 mLs per dose, which usually comes in a small vial. I think there's benefits logistically to the guys on the ground that are using that. They can carry more of it, and it's not going to be as space consuming and heavy. It's just as effective. We also know that it can be given in repeat bolus doses over 48-hour periods, 5-day periods, according to some of the papers that have been written on it, without significant adverse effects arising from that as well. So I think that this is something that we should seriously consider looking at in the not too distant future. And honestly, a couple of the groups have already started doing that. I've talked to a couple of the Air Force PJs and their docs recently, and they're looking seriously at changing their guidelines and recommendations to include 23.4% in their practice.
Is there any change as far as duration of effect? Because, I mean, you're talking 23.4, say 30 mLs, versus 3% at 250 mLs. Are the effects and the duration roughly the same?
Yeah, there was a neurosurgery journal that had published on this a couple of years back, and they had looked at a couple of different concentrations and duration of actions, and there didn't seem to be a significant difference between the concentrations in terms of their ICP lowering effect. They compared a lot of them to mannitol at some point in there when they were doing this review, and it did seem to have a bit of a more profound effect on ICP and a longer lasting effect than mannitol, at least in this review. That's a bit of a controversial statement, according to some people, at least. But that's what these individuals had found. But to answer your question, I don't think that there's a significant difference in the ICP lowering effect or the efficacy of a higher concentration versus a lower concentration. Because really, you can get kind of an equimolar dosing if you give one or the other. 30 cc's, for example, of 23.4% is going to be about 230, 240 cc's of 3%. If you try to make it an equivalent dosing, considering the two concentration differences. So not much of a difference clinically. I think, again, a lot of it is just logistically, how much of it can you carry and how burdensome is it to the guys on the ground?
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Now, I know 23.4% has an NSN. I think some units' ability to get it are going to be different than others. But I am confident that any unit would be able to get 8.4% sodium bicarbonate. And I've definitely heard it being used for ICP, at least in a pinch, until they get whatever other treatments available. What do you think about using sodium bicarbonate?
So yeah, so the problem that you preface that with is absolutely true. In addition to that, I would say I am aware of a couple of units who have said, hey, they give me fluid bags and they give me a 30 cc vial of 23.4%. But then they tell me I have to dilute that out to 3% in accordance with the guidelines. And how do I do that? And that's where we've had to bring in some of our pharmacists to tell them how much of that 30 cc vial, 23.4%, they have to put into their normal saline or their LR bags in order to get a 3%. The bottom line being, this stuff doesn't always come ready made for you. So that's a time consuming effort in some cases. Especially in a patient who is rapidly declining, that could be potentially detrimental to you and your intervention. So you bring up 8.4% sodium bicarbonate, and we've actually known for some years, or have had evidence for some years, that using that in cerebral edema, increased intracranial pressure, is effective at lowering that. And I had actually shied away from that a couple of years ago, mostly because the level of evidence of it was a lot lower than it had been for some of the typical hypertonic solutions. I've since changed my mind for a couple of different reasons. One of them is that you find that people get scared sometimes or anxious about administering hypertonic solutions because of a lot of the myths about it for so long and some of the complications that can arise. But they will give 8.4% sodium bicarb to a severely acidotic trauma patient without a second thought, and sometimes several ampules. But when you calculate it out, 8.4% sodium bicarb ends up being about the equivalent of 6% hypertonic saline. So you're actually giving something that has double the concentration of 3%. And for that reason, you can carry more of it. You can give smaller volumes of it, to get the same effect that you would from 3%. It would end up being, if you wanted to give a 200 cc bolus of 3%, that would end up being about 2 ampules or 250 cc ampules of 8.4% sodium bicarb, which is the recommended dose for ICP in a lot of the papers. And it seems to work well. A lot of times those ampules, like say they're ready made, they're ready to go. So you can push them very quickly. They're available. And if you were in a situation where your hypertonic solution wasn't available or wasn't ready, then I think that's a reasonable alternative to consider. One of the caveats being that if you've got a severely alkalotic patient, either metabolic or respiratory, it may not be a great option to give to those patients. But in trauma, you're probably talking about somebody who's acidotic. So that's not a real significant concern, I think, in a lot of these patients. But I think that's a reasonable alternative.
For what we forgot to go over is for either the 23.4 or sodium bicarbonate, how fast are you administering it? Since you're not putting it in a bag, you imagine you're pushing it through a syringe. So how long do you administer that over?
The 23.4%, our practice where I work in a unit, it's generally over 10 minutes. So the bicarb actually can be pushed a lot faster than that, because you see that being used in cardiac arrest or circulatory shock and trauma, where it has to go in pretty quickly. Certainly, there's ways to administer that via infusion and such, and that does happen usually in ICUs or in EDs, but you can push that one pretty quickly.
Okay. Well, I know for ACLS, pushing bicarb, I mean, they're dead.
Yes.
So you can't really get worse than that.
That's right.
It's hard to anyway.
That's right.
So, I mean, rapid administration. But would you recommend maybe over 10 minutes just to be on the safe side?
I don't know that it would make
that big of a difference.
Much of a difference at that concentration. I think that the higher concentrations, sometimes there's some complications with pushing the higher concentrations a little bit too quickly. So that's why we err on the side of caution. At one point, it was some of the papers were recommending 23.4% at 20 to 30 minutes. But it seems that more recently, and certainly in my practice, 10 minutes seems to be fine.
All right, very good. Now, as far as hypertonic, the way the CPG is written now, it's used as kind of a rescue drug for signs of herniation. If I see my patient declining, but he isn't obviously herniating, would it be safe to prophylactically treat him with hypertonic?
I would never fault somebody who had a patient with a mechanism and the clinical signs and symptoms of a TBI, especially a declining patient like you're describing, Dennis. I would never fault them for saying, I think I want to go ahead and give some hypertonic saline or some osmotic therapy to this patient. Building on that, you know, have I seen the emergency departments do that with patients that come in with a really low GCS that they may not even be 100% sure there's a TBI associated with high likelihood, but maybe not sure, haven't gotten their CT scans yet or any kind of intracranial monitoring to assess ICP. Have I seen those docs push it? Yes, absolutely. So I think that I think that using clinical judgment, if that's your assessment and that's your concern, I think that's reasonable. Where I think the concern comes up with your question, or where I would kind of put a halt or step on the brake a little bit with your question would be, is it reasonable in somebody who maybe is not a severe TBI, at least not yet, maybe they're more in the moderate category, is it worth pushing their sodiums up prophylactically to try to cause that osmotic shift in fluid from the interstitial space to the intravascular space? That is a little bit trickier to answer, and that was something that was pushed for a little while as an idea, and we were doing that in our unit. But there seems to be a difference in the way that the body processes a continuous infusion of a hypertonic solution versus bolus dosing. And we've seen that in both animal models and human models. In rats, for example, one study had shown that continuous infusions of hypertonic saline in rats who they created a stroke in, infarct volume seemed to expand. So it suggested that edema actually got worse. You also worry about pushing the sodiums high and then not being able to continue the infusion or having to stop it for some reason that the change in sodium level might cause an edema exacerbation as well. So that's another thing that you don't typically see with bolus dosing, especially over the time frames that we're talking about. If your patient is awake and you try to push the sodiums up, it tends to make them very thirsty and frankly quite miserable. So that's another consequence that you're having to address. And frankly, as well with the changes in neuronal toxicity that can occur with continuous infusions, if you get to a point where you're prophylactically trying to elevate or have been prophylactically trying to elevate the sodium levels and you have to give a bolus dose of hypertonic because of a decline in an exam or because of a suspected change in ICP, you may not get the same clinical effect that you would if you had just waited and done the bolus dosing. So I think that I don't use infusions for that purpose. And I think a lot of my colleagues recommend against them and or are moving away from them. I don't see them as often as I used to. So I think the original answer to your question is yes. If there's a strong clinical suspicion, go ahead and give that dose. But I would not try to push somebody's sodium levels higher with prophylactic doses before it's clinically necessary.
Okay. Another thing that goes with TBI is seizures. And often these seizures are maybe hidden or subclinical, or you can't really tell that this is it's an actual seizure because it's not a grand mal seizure. It's not blatantly obvious. Is there any benefit to just prophylactically treating somebody to prevent a seizure just because it can be so detrimental for these patients?
Yes. So the answer to that question is probably. You would be hard-pressed to find a guideline that makes a hard recommendation about seizure prophylaxis in TBI, in hemorrhage, or some of those other conditions, or subarachnoid hemorrhage, intraparenchymal hemorrhage, some of those other conditions that are associated with seizure on a fairly regular basis. You were asking questions about things like non-convulsive status epilepticus, or it's a seizure where there are very subtle clinical signs of ongoing seizure activity. These can be very difficult to spot without an electroencephalogram or EEG monitoring, but that could be a reason that your patient is not improving despite your resuscitative efforts. So it's worth considering in that case whether or not a patient is experiencing a non-convulsive seizure. But I think the other reason to consider this, despite the fact that there's not any hard recommendation or guideline for it, is that if you wait for a seizure to occur in a patient who has a moderate or severe TBI, that is one of the reasons that you can end up with an acute elevation in ICP. So not only are you having to deal with and try to terminate the seizure as that occurs, but you're potentially having to grapple with the ICP complications that arise as a result of that seizure activity. So I think that while there are no guidelines that say, yes, absolutely, you should do AED prophylaxis in a TBI patient, and it's hard to know which one of them are going to seize. A lot of that is based off of the degree of injury, the type of hematomas, and what compartments those hematomas are in. But I think that if you look at the bigger picture and your concern is, I don't want to run into an ICP problem with this patient, if you have the ability to prophylactically administer an anticonvulsive therapy to that patient, you should strongly consider doing it. The one thing I'll say as a follow-up to that statement is, I would probably use something, when I say a prophylactic dose, I would probably use something outside of the benzo category. Primarily because we know that benzos have a depressive effect on the sensorium. So administering a benzodiazepine without having to, the caveat to that or the downside to that is that you will probably lose some of your neuro exam. And then you have to ask the question, is that my medication or is that their TBI getting worse? And that can be difficult to answer in the austere environment. So benzos I would reserve, like midazolam, for acute seizure activity that's occurring in front of you. If you have the ability to carry or are carrying something like levetiracetam or Keppra, I think that that's reasonable to give up front to get on board to try to prevent a seizure from happening so you're not playing catch up down the road if that's something that manifests.
Okay. So you already recommended Keppra, which has a pretty easy dosing profile. Is there any other medications that you would recommend?
I like, and I think that a lot of the organizations that I have spoken with they're really trying to get Kepler because, like you said, it's an easy dose. Usually gives somewhere between 1 to 1.5 grams up front as a loading dose, and then somewhere between 500 milligrams to a gram every 12 hours. So if you've got that, great. In terms of other medications that are available, if you're in an environment where there's not some of those more modern resources, then finding something like Dilantin or Phenytoin or even pentobarbital or phenobarbital or one of the barbiturates, those can be useful as well. Those are fairly inexpensive and common throughout the globe. So you could certainly search something like that out and then get on the VTC to help get dosing instructions for those types of medications. But ideally, if something like levetiracetam is available, I think that's a great drug because it's effective. It doesn't interact with other medications, and it's easy to use.
Okay. Do you have any updates in monitoring?
Yeah. So the question I think that comes up not infrequently is what are we looking at to help us quantify changes in cerebral edema or increased intracranial pressure and in a non-invasive manner? So as you probably know, when we wrote the original guidelines, we decided to include optic nerve sheath diameter measurements as an option to help quantify, at least to some degree, ICP changes in individuals. And there's a lot of people that do not like that. I've run into a number of people who they do not think it works. They think that the numbers are unreliable. Certainly the data has shown that there are various cutoffs depending on what trial or what series you're looking at in terms of what diameter is associated with an elevated ICP. That's all true. And I've always told folks that if you're going to use optic nerve sheath diameters, I think the trends are more useful than any particular number, and look at those values over time as opposed to just one single value and look at side-to-side difference as well. Some of the recent discussion regarding optic nerve sheath diameter is that 3 millimeter measurement that you make. In other words, you measure 3 millimeters back from where the optic nerve inserts into the posterior globe. That is the typical location that most of the papers have recommended measuring from. A couple more recent papers have said that there seem to be a lot of fluctuations in that particular area of the optic nerve. So they said that maybe measuring from 8 millimeters back is more effective and gives you more stable variations, at least in the ICP. The nerve diameter measurement. And there's a couple of other folks who have said that maybe what we should be doing is creating a ratio where we measure the globe size and compare that to the optic nerve sheath diameter, and that may give us a better idea about when there is high pressure. I think that the physiology behind it is sound because you've got you've got subarachnoid fluid, you've got that tissue surrounding the optic nerve. So when there's high ICP, that fluid gets shunted into that sheath, and you get expanses in that sheath. I think the question now is where is the best place to measure that, or what is the best way to make use of that data? It's certainly a tool that we have. Most of the medics these days are pretty familiar with how to use ultrasound. It's not hard to learn how to do after you do a couple of iterations of it. But I think it's evolving to some degree as to the best way to utilize that and incorporate it. Unfortunately, it's also probably the best tool that we have right now in this setting to non-invasively assess ICP. People have talked about using pupillometry and pupil changes. The problem is things like papilledema, sluggish pupils, they can be nonspecific and or they can take hours to manifest, which may not help you in the acute setting. So I don't think that that's as useful to the folks in the field. And then you've got some other modalities like transcranial Doppler, which I just don't think are feasible for that type of environment. There's some modalities that are in the works. One of them is using earbuds basically to analyze autoacoustic emissions and translate that into an intracranial pressure. But it's not ready for widespread clinical use yet. And it still needs to be tested and compared to invasive methods to make sure it's accurate. So right now, we're still going to go with the optic nerve sheath diameters. But that's probably going to be revised in the not too distant future, as we learn and understand more about how to better utilize that modality.
Now, regardless of what modality you use, do you still think it's better to go with trends versus absolute values?
I think if we're talking about the optic nerve sheath diameters in particular, yes. And the one thing that your question made me think of is I think it's important for the audience to remember that, like so many tests in medicine, there is no, or very infrequently at least, there is usually not one single test or intervention that will give you the answer that you want. Clinical judgment, in this case, the neuro exam, is still going to be your best tool. And I think that, you know, even when you work in a location like an ICU that has all of these advanced monitoring equipment or imaging modalities, a lot of times the decisions we make are helped in some cases by that equipment, but a lot of it is based off of our clinical judgment and our neuro exam. So, if you really think that somebody is having an ICP crisis, I wouldn't wait to use the optic nerve sheath diameter measurements to confirm that. I'd go ahead and intervene, in accordance with what we talked to you about in the CPGs.
Another thing I've heard coming down as far as pre-hospital is actual more definitive interventions other than hypertonic or anything that can just reduce swelling. They're talking about actually opening the cranium either through burr holes or some other method. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, a little bit. This had come up a couple of years ago at MHSRS, as I recall, with one of the Air Force neurosurgeons, Randall McCafferty. And when I was recently at the emergency war surgery course, one of the neurosurgeons there from Brook was teaching the general surgeons how to do crude decompressive hemicraniectomy. So the traditional endpoint for a lot of these TBI patients, as you probably know, Dennis, is to try to get them to a surgeon so that they can be decompressed. And decompression in TBI is a little bit of a controversial issue. We know it saves lives. It doesn't necessarily improve outcomes. So its benefit is a topic of discussion, and choosing the right patients for that is certainly something that occurs on a case-by-case basis. But we do know that it seems to save lives, and that's usually where we're trying to get these individuals. The problem is, there's not a whole lot of neurosurgeons out there. And if you're in an austere environment, you may be even further away from a neurosurgeon that can do this procedure. So, you know, what I was getting at earlier was there has been discussion about protocols coming out that would allow certain general surgeons who have done a couple of iterations of the procedure and trained on the procedure be able to do decompressive hemicraniectomies. And I've known a few that are interested in learning how to do that and in incorporating that into their practice in the deployed setting if need be. So I think one of the ideas there is that even if you're in the middle of nowhere with a patient with a TBI, and you're almost certain that there's no neurosurgeon anywhere nearby, it's probably not a bad idea to see if you can find a general surgeon who's willing to or has trained on that modality and is potentially able to intervene. The other thing that has been done too, there's certainly been cases of this, is where there is no neurosurgeon available, you get them to a general surgeon who has a good VTC capability and they can get a neurosurgeon on video more or less to help them with that procedure. And to get that skull off, and then of course evacuate them to that higher level of care that has neurosurgical capability. So I think that there is we certainly looked at certainly for larger conflicts and larger volumes of patients allowing non-neurosurgeons to do this procedure. And I would always ask because you do occasionally get one or there's some neurointensivists that have done this on occasion as well and have learned how to do this. I think it's worthwhile trying to check around and see if there's anybody else that can do that or is willing to do it. If the neurosurgeon isn't available. Another thought is, I think we talked about this a couple of years ago, but, Tom Scalia from UMM, had published, some papers a couple of years back on doing decompressive laparotomies or thoracotomies for refractory ICP, excuse me. And, That's certainly something that general surgeons are capable of doing. It seemed to be effective, whether or not they had a hemicrania done before or afterward, it seemed to be effective in lowering ICP. So that's something that, that a surgeon might be more comfortable trying in order to save that patient's life and to buy some time. The other thing that I would remind people too is that we talk about things like burr holes, and there are certain situations where something like that may be able to evacuate a hematoma, epidural being the big one. That would also buy you some time to get that patient to a higher level of care and definitive care. Remember, though, that just because you can do something or think you can do something doesn't always necessarily mean that you should. So there are things that I feel like I could do in the right situation, in a dire situation, but that doesn't mean that I should do them, particularly if this is a patient who doesn't absolutely need it, and I can get them to somebody who does this on a more regular basis and is better practiced than I am. So that's kind of an across-the-board recommendation for anybody who practices any type of medicine, but certainly in some of these, in considerations for some of these neurosurgical interventions. You see them done a few times. You do a few yourself and you think, hey, this is no problem. I can do this. But the reason that that it takes years to do these is they don't always go like they should. And that's where the expertise and the experience really comes in, so that you make sure that you're not hurting somebody more by whatever intervention you're planning on making.
So you're saying because I own a DeWalt drill is not the reason to drill a hole into somebody's head.
That's right. Just because, and you're not far off from that, because there have been instances where people have tried to do these or have done them with dental drills, which are extremely small, and you're going to get a tiny, tiny hole. So not only is that going to be labor intensive, but, you know, again, ask yourself, does this patient really need that? Do I have to do this to save their life or extend their life? And if the answer is no, then I would probably wait and let the folks that are experienced in doing it do it.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely agree. Talking about this in the office, you know, everybody talks about the actual procedure of drilling a hole in somebody's head. That's probably not the question of, do you know how to turn it on and put pressure behind the bit? One, knowing where to do it and what to do if you screw up. But also had a comment of, what about the environment that you're in? If you have mouse and rat crap all over your aid station, it's probably not the greatest to go ahead and do craniotomy or something.
No, the point you bring up is it's a valid point. I would say, if, again, in an ICP crisis, if your patient has a blown pupil and is a GCS of 3 now right in front of you, that's probably somebody that, you say, well, this isn't going to be pretty. This is going to be dirty. And frankly, outside of the operating room, non-neurosurgeons were talking about doing this. That's probably going to be the case. It's probably not going to be a cosmetically great hemicrania that you're going to get. And are you at risk for infection? Absolutely. But if it saves their life right there and then we worry about the consequences later. Are infections from surgical complications and neurosurgery devastating? Absolutely, they can be. And that still puts the patient at a high risk for short-term mortality. And if you can avoid it, you want to avoid it. But in the situation that your audience is in, a lot of times, I think that's one of those things you just say, well, we'll deal with that later if we have to.
Now, as a neurointensivist and somebody who has had to deal with these patients before, at what point do you just draw the line and say, I'm not going to dig this hole any deeper with going through burr holes and, austere hemicraniectomies with my field knife? I'm actually just going to move to palliative care and put an end to this.
Sure. This has also been something that has come out in guidelines, and certainly in civilian institutions, there are certain patients that we receive that we just say, there's really not going to be a high likelihood of any beneficial effect from this procedure. They might live, but they're going to be neurologically devastated. Things that that kind of key people into that traditionally have been GCSs of 3 to 5, fixed and dilated pupils. Somebody that you can look at and say, this is going to be incredibly labor intensive and resource requirements are going to be high, and I could pour all of that into this individual, but they're either not going to survive, and if by some miracle they do, they're going to be neurologically devastated for the rest of their life. So I think that you can look at some of those lower GCS patients and their neuro exams and say, there's already been significant damage done And this is probably somebody that, that I'm either not going to be able to save, or is just not going to do well, even if they do manage to survive. Now, I will say this though, that I think it's worthwhile attempting some degree of resuscitation, even in more, even in these more serious TBI patients. A colleague of mine from Duke, one of the neurosurgeons up there that's really into trauma, brilliant young guy, told me once that that he actually thinks that the worst GCS score is a 4. And that makes a lot of sense. And on the scale, the worst GCS score is actually a 3. But if you think about it, a 3 is basically a patient that doesn't do anything with their eyes, with their motor response, or their verbal response. But there's a lot of things that could be involved in the acute situation prior to resuscitation that might depress cerebral activity, neuronal activity, and cause you to be that unresponsive. Acidosis, hypothermia, for example. So what Jordan was getting at when he said that, and what I agree with completely, is when you see a patient with a 3, you think, maybe if I fix these things, I'll start to get a neuro exam back. And in my experience, that's the case. So I think that if you have a 3, even though that's the lowest score, it's worth trying to fix those sorts of things before you write that patient off. The 4, on the other hand, what we're saying is that there is just a sliver of neurologic activity still available. In most cases, your 4 is going to come from extension to pain when you're doing the motor part of your GCS score. That's saying that there is just enough brain to be working, and that the systemic insult is not severe enough to suppress that. But that suggests that there is widespread neurologic devastation because only certain parts of the brainstem are actually still working to produce that response. That is something that that I think you see and you think, gosh, this person is in bad shape. So don't write them off completely. Look for some of those things that you can intervene on or fix and see how their exam does. But I think you're right. It's worth asking yourself or your consult, your teleconsult, whether this is somebody that that is salvageable and you should continue to pour effort and labor and resources into.
Outstanding. Hey, thank you, David. This is awesome. Are you and the other members of the working group looking to update the CPG?
You know, I had gotten an email. Gosh, it's probably about a year ago that had talked about that, and so the short answer is yes. I think life just intervened, and people got distracted with other projects. But you know, based off of what we were talking about today, and some of the data that has come out or is emerging on TBI, I think that an update is in the not too distant future, and it's something I'd be happy to work with the PFC working group on in order to accomplish. So hopefully we'll be seeing an update in the not too distant future.
Hey, very good. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Dennis.
That's it for today's podcast. Be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC podcast. Every boy is waiting there for you.